B-Pod Studios.
Ready, set, go!
This is Checkpoint XP Daily, your daily dose of esports and video game discussion. A complete look at all things esports and gaming. A production of Beasley Esports XP. Here are your hosts, Nate Bender, Robbie Landis, Norris Howard, and Joe Sloan.
Checkpoint reached.
Hey, welcome into Checkpoint XP Daily for Friday, January 4th, 2019, your daily source for esports and video game discussion. I want to thank everyone listening on 98.5, the Sports Hub of Boston, as well as the Team 980 in Washington, D.C. Coming up today on Checkpoint XP Daily, the first female player in the Overwatch Contenders League has quit due to harassment. Or so we thought. We'll break down that situation. Plus, we're sharing interviews featured on our first national show of 2019, Checkpoint XP's educational special. Today, we'll check out our conversation with Samantha Anton of the North American Scholastic Esports Federation, or NASEF. Those conversations are ahead today here on Checkpoint XP Daily. But we start today with Blizzard. Blizzard and Activision have a long history together going back to 2008 when Activision merged with Vivendi Games, which Blizzard had been a part of since 1996. But recently, stories have started to emerge from former Blizzard employees that Activision is starting to take a more heavy-handed role in managing Blizzard. And it's got some fans worried.
Yeah, this is something that Kotaku sort of put out there. And really what it does is it kind of looks at the inevitability that the gaming industry has. I mean, let's look back at some of the darling developers of our past. Square Enix, Konami, BioWare, for example. You know, all of them have had these major falls from grace, and they've happened. It's not something that happens overnight. You know, it doesn't just change one day. We hate them. It's an internal thing. You know, by the time that Mass Effect 3 had actually launched, and, you know, with all the I guess, controversy that was around that, a lot of the original development staff and people from BioWare were gone at that point, and the same thing is sort of happening to Blizzard right now.
I mean, it's happened in a lot of different companies, right? Like the original Infinity Ward. That was basically
they
cleared house in that company, and the people who now are employed in Infinity Ward are no longer the same people who made the Call of Duty series what it is, right? Like there was a specific set of developers that really helped form that series into what it is, and then they were suddenly very quickly shown the door. Or, you know, you've got tons of other examples. As you had pointed out, Square Enix. Squaresoft was a company that was famous for a lot of things, including graphics software development. And after they had put out that Final Fantasy movie, Spirits Within, they
were out of money, bro.
They basically had run through all of the money that the Final Fantasy franchise had brought in, and they had to merge with Enix, who was the creators of the Dragon Quest franchise, which was Final Fantasy's main competitor. And since then, people have noticed that merger took a lot of the creative freedom that Squaresoft enjoyed. And took that edge off.
But based on that, why people are saying this about Blizzard is because over the past year, Mike Morhaime, he stepped down as president.
That was a big one.
Of Blizzard. That was absolutely huge. He had been on since, what, 90?
He's a co-founder.
Yeah, he's a co-founder.
The beginning.
91.
And so, you know, when you lose sort of the, beyond just your management head, your top executive,
who was
the spirit of your company.
And for Blizzard, too. It's not really the developers that we're losing, though a lot of shifting has been going on there as well. And obviously, there have been some that are moving on. But specifically, it's been a lot up in like the executive sort of, as you said, Norris, the management sort of area. And whenever one of these, you know, longtime Blizzard employees leaves, it's Activision that's now filling the shoes. Bobby Kotick of Activision, who I think has been with Activision since the beginning, is one of the ones who stepped into Morhaime's shoes.
And there was also news now earlier this week of the CFO stepping down. He's since been hired by Netflix. And so that's another void that they're going to have to be filled. We is yet to be seen if that'll be an Activision employee.
And we've been hearing reports out of former employees who have chosen to remain not anonymous that, you know, there has been a move towards cost-cutting measures specifically with Blizzard, that anything that's not really involved with direct game development is getting the axe and is getting scaled back. And I think that you can see the evidence of this most clearly with the dissolution of the hot scene.
Mm-hmm. Now, and that's not to say, by the way, too, that any of the decisions that are made this way didn't need to happen, right?
Right. They're not necessarily cut, bad decisions.
Yes,
right.
Hots was the one that's on there. But one of the things that a lot of these employees are talking about that gives me a lot of pause is, first of all, Blizzard is known for putting out quality games, and if it takes 10 years to put that game out, they're going to take 10 years, but when you finally get it, that's a game that's going to stay in your library for a long time.
Sure.
The finance department seems to be growing larger and now having a say in some of the decisions that are being made, and what I'm afraid is going to happen is that Blizzard is going to take on more of an EA approach, and that immediately has a negative connotation.
Yeah, you're throwing up all kinds of red flags there.
But I want to get very specific about it. EA puts out a lot of games very frequently, and I think that that's what they want Blizzard to start doing, is because everything they put out is a blockbuster, you know, that it does well, they want to start putting out more of them.
Well, but at the same time, I think it's a little bit early to say that, especially considering we see that Blizzard is taking a major shift towards esports, and whether Activision has a large part of that decision, we don't really know. We're not in the boardroom there, but knowing that their shift is towards esports, seeing what they're doing with Overwatch League and how much money is coming in from Overwatch League, how much money StarCraft is still making, how much, you know, money that they see on the horizon for their other future products, you know, it is hard to see them sort of taking the EA stance, because to say that they would go that direction would be, you know, over-reliance on old engines, trying to make a bespoke engine that works for all of your games,
right?
Reliance on loot boxes. That stuff kind of is not really present here. Not those red flags.
True.
You're listening to Checkpoint XP Esports and Gaming Radio. I want to thank everyone listening on WEJS 1600 in Williamsport and Sports Radio 100.9 and 1070 in Madison, Wisconsin. We're currently talking about the increasing role that it seems like Activision is having in Blizzard properties. And I think what Robbie is referring to, and you can kind of pin this down to like a few specific decisions that Blizzard has been allowed to make. Right? Because even since, you know, like Blizzard has been a part of another company for a long time.
10 years.
Well, Vivendi had bought them, yeah, like even earlier than that. Mm-hmm. That was, I think, in the 90s that they had acquired Blizzard. So they had always had people overseeing their decisions. But Blizzard being Blizzard and their games doing very well, they do have a degree of freedom of what they're allowed to do. Mm-hmm. So projects like StarCraft Ghost, and what was the one that got canceled?
That was turned into Overwatch?
Yes.
Titans, I think it was called?
And a project like Titans, would Blizzard still be allowed to make the difficult decision, this doesn't live up to our standard, we're going to scrap it in favor of a game like Overwatch, which arguably did way better than Titans probably would have
been projected. And I think, you know, Activision giving them that freedom to make those decisions shows that there is some sort of good faith between the two entities. I think it's very different when you saw the relationship between EA and BioWare, where you saw the immediate effects of top-down management, mm-hmm. from the way games were developed, from what they were putting in games, how they reacted to fan feedback.
But I think that's the concern, though, especially if Activision is replacing ex-Blizzard personnel with Activision
staff.
But
that would have happened already. After a decade plus, it would have happened already.
I don't know.
Seriously.
Because you can have a culture shift.
I think it would have happened already. If this was something that would have happened, if Activision was looking for some sort of hostile creative takeover of Blizzard, that's something that they could have did the moment they purchased them. But they didn't. EA did it. Enix did it. Konami did it. It happened to everybody.
But we don't know the internal struggle that Blizzard has had to mount to be able to maintain their creative freedom.
I find it suspect that we start to see all these big decisions and what could be a big shift, because Norris, you are right. It could just end up being nothing, right? But that it happens right at the moment that Mike Morhaime decides to step down. He could have been the one that was holding back that flood this whole time.
A lot of times.
And I will not disagree with that. But what I will say is that can also be a decision from multiple people from a board of directors saying, look at what we're doing with esports. That's where we're going to shift our focus. And multiple executives could say that's not where we want our focus to be. And they could leave out of there and they replace them with Activision people. That could be all this is. is. And right now, based on the esports climate, who's doing it better than Blizzard? Tell me.
There's very Nobody. Few, which is why Activision is taking cues from Blizzard and not mimicking, but at least taking influence in the way that they're running CWL, like the way that they run OWL, which is smart. Very, very smart. But the thing is I echo Robbie's concern to in the way that Blizzard has been able to self-manage. You know as well as anyone else that a lot of times there can be that one person very high inside of a company that has a lot of pull and is very well respected that can hold back a decision for far longer than it deserves to be held back.
I worry
that now Morheim is gone, that a decision like that could fall forward.
Well,
and we might
time,
start
dude,
seeing the soul of Blizzard,
but at the same time, I still think there's a lot of false smoke that may not even lead to a fire. A lot of people said the same thing about when Iwata passed at Nintendo, and
after
he was gone, Nintendo made major shifts that everybody was happy with. So we got to let this play out.
You're right, because sometimes that same person can also be a stick in a river that's, you know, going against the current and making bad decisions. You're absolutely right. Listen, we want to hear from you. Are you concerned that Blizzard could one day become a shell of its former self? Connect with us on social media. That's Checkpoint XP on Facebook and Twitter, and Checkpoint_XP on Instagram. Still ahead on Checkpoint XP Daily, we'll take a listen to our conversation with Samantha Anton from the North American Scholastic Esports Federation, or NASEF. That conversation will wrap up today's Checkpoint XP Daily. But ahead next, the first female player in Overwatch Contenders League has officially quit the league due to harassment. Or so we thought. This story has multiple layers, and we'll unpack all of them as we know them. Ahead next on Checkpoint XP Daily.
This is Checkpoint XP, Esports and Gaming Radio. This is Checkpoint XP, Esports and Gaming Radio. CheckpointXP.com.
Hey, welcome back to Checkpoint XP Daily, your home for esports and gaming. I want to thank everyone listening on CBS Sports Radio 1300 in Baltimore, as well as the Ticket 1230 in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina. Make sure you visit our website at checkpointxp.com to subscribe to our growing offering of podcasts. You can also follow us on Twitch at twitch.tv/checkpointxp to join the show live or connect with us on social media. That's Checkpoint XP on Facebook and Twitter, and checkpoint_XP on Instagram. Overwatch Contenders League passed a milestone and then quickly undid that same milestone shortly thereafter. The first female player was signed to a North American Overwatch Contenders team, a player by the name of Ellie. Well, because we can't ever seem to have anything nice, the news quickly snowballed into the realm of conspiracy theories about the person's identity, and then plot twist, those conspiracy theories ended up being right!
Yeah, it's really weird. So let me just give you guys some background if you haven't been following in this story. A second wind, the Overwatch Contenders team here in North America, signed a player by the name of Ellie. Nobody knew who this person was.
Yes.
They weren't present on the ladders like that. It was a low-level account. And this person just came out of nowhere. There were some streams that this person was doing where, you know, you couldn't really make out, you know, how this person was playing, who was actually talking. And thus, the internet became suspicious. That corner, that dark, dusty corner of the internet that has become quite illuminated in
now,
the past few years.
Now, here's the thing, is that it's not unfair in the announcement of a signing for someone, for interested parties, to want to go and do research about that player.
Not
nothing
at all.
Wrong at
that's
all.
Perfectly
not
normal.
At all.
That's perfectly normal.
And justified as fans of a particular team.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there was definitely some red flags that were being thrown up.
Exactly. So usually when anybody involved in Overwatch gets signed to an official team, there's some fanfare involved. Some stuff goes up on Twitter. There's nice little branded posts with handshakes and, you know, the same stuff they do in, you know, traditional sports to announce this new signing. None of that happened with Second Wind. So even more people became suspicious.
Right.
And as time was going on in the days were rolling, People were trying to watch streams of this person and noticed that on voice comms, they were only really speaking before the match was beginning
and after
the match had ended.
Right.
Wasn't a part of making call outs, wasn't a part of any type of in-game strategy that require voice chat. So even more people got suspicious, and thus the even darker, dustier corner of the internet got involved, and there was one person by the name of Haunt sat back and actually threatened to dox this person. Suggested that they were going to dox this person, and that was the dog whistle. After that happened, you began really to see the rhetoric ramp up. You know, this is SJW type stuff. Everybody shouldn't be excited because this was a girl, da 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 da. And it became very ugly. Very quickly.
And I do think that the premise of what if this woman is a fake is a pretty bad premise to go off of. But I do think that it's not unnatural or weird in any way, shape, or form that when an announcement like this gets made, that fans of that game will naturally want to know more about the signing. And if red flags are going up that early on, and the identity of the person just so happens to be female, like I saw a lot of camp building, mm-hmm. right? People retreated back into their camp. They ceased to be Overwatch fans and they went back to their kind of their designated political
yep.
camps. And that's when the ugliness started. And I do think that, you know, both sides actually have a point here. And it is very frustrating that that kind of attempt to discredit someone ended up being valid.
Yeah, because now those people are looking at it because it was they had called it.
This is a victory.
Anything that they had done to get to that point is now justified.
Yeah, this is a victory, and that's the part that does make it.
Because we got to get to the plot
and
twist.
And that's the part that makes this disheartening. One other crazy theory I heard is that this person was actually Dream Casper, the disgraced Boston Boston Uprising player.
I hadn't heard
which,
that one.
I did hear that rumor.
Yeah.
But, I mean, and to be honest, this is still very much a breaking story. Because this last bit of plot twist, this broke 10 minutes before we were ready to open up the microphone.
I was pulling into the parking lot when this broke.
Yes.
So apparently, according to Slasher, who's a well-known tweeter and journalist in the Overwatch world.
Esports world,
to be fair, tweeted out that it is confirmed this person was not who they said they were. It was actually a 17-year-old girl who does play the game but is not very good at it.
Having somebody play on her behalf.
Somebody else was playing on her behalf.
Right.
Nobody at Second Wind knew, which brings up even more red flags for their organization. Contenders in general.
The source of this information is a tweet from someone who has been pretty reliable when it comes to information sourcing in the past. We cannot confirm any of this because we have not been able to do our journalistic due diligence. But, I mean, the fact that this story is evolving even right before the moment that we're talking about it is really crazy.
Yeah, it's insane. And the question that I would want to ask this person is, first of all, you were going to have to show up for competition.
What was the end game? What was the end game here?
This isn't even just what I'd ask the person. Even everyone, you know, in these different camps who you know, was doing everything, trying to figure everything out and the way they were doing it. How far did you think this would have gone?
Anyone who has ever cheated in esports, what is your fucking end game? Did you think no one would? That guy in an Optic India or whatever it was.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't. Was it Optic
India? No, he was with Optic India.
He was with Optic India that tried to fucking cheat at that tournament, and there's literally tournament organizers standing over his shoulder. What do you think you're going to do at that point? Right? Like, what was the end game of this Ellie person once you had to show up for a tournament in person? Were you just going to suck live? Like, listen, you're not going to be like NoFX and be like, well, I heard she sucks live, but she's really good when she's on live. No, what is that? Like, what is that? There's no logic that's even being applied to the scam. How did this happen?
And that's the question that I want to ask second. When is how on earth did you allow somebody to get as far as have a contract put in front of them where they could sign their name and you didn't do your due diligence?
And that's the second
that you hadn't sat behind them and watched them,
and watched
play.
Them play.
And that's the second part of the Slasher tweet, is that Blizzard is investigating. Mm-hmm. So again, this is very much up for debate. This is not confirmed. It's still a very much evolving and breaking story. We're going to continue to cover it into next week, but just very interesting how stories like that evolve over time. There's actually another story that we were going to talk about today. We had three segments planned out today, and even our third segment got dashed by this whole, by just the way that news cycles operate.
Yeah, so we were also going to touch on the Mr. Deadmoth situation.
Right.
Where, if you don't remember,
we talked about him several weeks ago.
Yep, we talked about him before the end of the year. This was the streamer that unfortunately assaulted his girlfriend on stream. They were in the middle of an argument and he slapped her and punched her.
Yep, you can hear the altercation.
You see and hear the altercation. It was very difficult to watch.
Very obvious domestic abuse on stream.
Very much so. He was summarily suspended from Twitch for unnamed number of days as he was going through his legal issues pertaining to that case. He was slated to come back, I believe, a couple days before recording of this segment, and got so far as to announce everything on Twitter, get people ramped up.
I
actually
went live. Yep. I think at least twice.
Went live, and afterwards, his account has now been resuspended by Twitch.
And even Twitch issued a statement about it today. That's still very much a developing story that we have our eyes on, and something that we'll revisit talking about this story next week if there's something to talk about.
Yeah.
It seems like, at least from the outside, that at the end of the day, Twitch has done the right thing and continued to suspend the account. I think, part of the what's at the heart of that question is, whether or not, someone who has this kind of legal trouble or personal demons should be able to have access to a platform like Twitch.
Without a doubt.
Is there a moral responsibility for Twitch to step in and not allow someone that has some very deep personal problems and obviously can't keep those problems in check, to at least keep them off of his damn stream, that, someone like that may not deserve to have a platform like Twitch supporting them.
And the concept that there was no permaban issue was a question that a lot of people were asking.
Totally. I think that that's a very valid question.
A completely valid one. Again, we are following this story as it develops. But I think these two stories are very interesting and very, very important for us to highlight, because it goes back to the question of what is happening in the culture.
Yeah.
Why is the culture consistently having incidents like the Ellie incident, on both ends, by the way,
sure,
of somebody impersonating somebody and to get as far as almost money to people to sort of continually bring up the validity of the skill of a female gamer?
But, okay, and I think that juxtaposition is really important. And, Ellie in our Twitch chat really brings up a great point. Great, now along with being asked if I'm really a girl or a 12-year-old boy, I'm going to be asked if I'm even playing. And I think that that's very I can see that that's exhausting.
It's a double edged and that's the crazy part, is that it's a double edged sword for us as male gamers, It's a sword where the sword is the handle that leads to another sword. There's no winning here for girl gamers. There is no win here for anyone, especially if you're a female gamer. You've been caught up in the most catch 22 of all, because now you will get both of those questions and people will feel empowered to do so.
Absolutely. However, the Mr. Deadmoth situation, I think, actually brings in a bigger question that we're struggling with right now in our culture. When our celebrities or the people that we look up to fall or are human, make mistakes, have faults and failures about them, how do we then move forward? You know, like Louis C.K. is a great example of this, right? Like, Louis C.K. is not just guilty of what he has admitted to being guilty of. He's now trying to restart his comedy career. And we've seen time after time, his set has been recorded surreptitiously. You know, he's been outed by people, you know, by making off-color jokes. He's a comedian.
He's going to make off-color jokes.
And you know what? He's allowed to do that, and he's allowed to workshop material.
Yeah.
And he's allowed to tell a joke that doesn't work or a bad joke. He's allowed to do that. At what point do you get to have a return, if you even get to have a return? But Michael Richards never got a return, nor do I think he deserves one. But how do we actually, as a culture, decide that, right? Like, what's the line? What is the line?
It's a tough question. I definitely think, though, that when it pertains to something like a physical or a sexual assault,
absolutely,
that's a pretty hard line.
That's a hard line to cross. That's a hard line to cross back over.
And I mean,
it's not like other celebrities haven't been able to do it.
Dude, I've been watching this R. Kelly documentary.
Exactly.
Like, I can't wait to watch the rest of it.
But, like, look at just the difference between R. Kelly and Mr. Deadmoth. Mr. Deadmoth waited all of 2 weeks before trying to get his streaming career back.
Yeah.
R. Kelly would disappear for like 4 years at a time. How long was it since you heard from R. Kelly after the Chappelle Show bit? Right? Like, it was a while.
It was like 2.5 years.
It was a while. People, like, kind of forgot about it.
Because it was Best of Both Worlds, then the tape came out, then he was gone for a couple years.
When did the Closet Saga happen? It was somewhere in there.
Oh, you know what? He dropped that in, like, 2004.
That's right, yeah.
So it was like a year.
I mean, like, you know, like, if you disappear long enough, it seems like, oh, yeah, the people will forget stuff. But, like, I'm 100% with you, Norris. If it's violent, if it's sexual, like, whatever it is, if that's the kind of thing, Twitch really kind of does have a moral obligation to kind of go, this is not the caliber of person that I want on our platform.
And I hate to make this false equivalency, but I have to put it out there, is that if you can permaban or think about banning people for wearing suggestive clothing.
Thank you.
Then
how does this not cross that same line?
How does this not cross the same threshold?
Right.
I think that's a valid question. So again, we'll follow this story as it continues to develop, because I don't want Twitch to be porn either. You know, I'm not saying that.
Right.
But I do think that Twitch and YouTube and gaming as a whole, the streaming community, and whatever that entails, has a lot of soul searching to do in the next few weeks. But let's start 2019 off in a way that's logical, that's good, that's holistic, so we can move forward and we can understand that these types of people are the people that we don't want representing our culture.
That's the realest voice in gaming journalism right there.
And just in case we forgot to overlook it or we didn't mention, Twitch did reinstate that ban.
Yep.
So Mr. Deadmoth is no longer a part of the platform. I don't know if that is a permanent ban. That is unclear at this time. Again, as Norris had mentioned, we are going to be continuing to follow these stories and continue to keep up on them. If there's any movement in them, we will revisit them next week, possibly even for the national show. Weird that it happened to not just one, but two segments on today's show. So definitely worth talking about. But listen, we want to hear from you. Were you caught up in the mystery surrounding the identity of Ellie? Should something like this even be something that we even care about? Connect with us on social media. That's Checkpoint XP on Facebook and Twitter, and Checkpoint underscore XP on Instagram. Coming up next on Checkpoint XP Daily, we'll check out our conversation with Samantha Anton of NACEF as we continue to share interviews featured on our first national show of 2019, Checkpoint XP's educational special. Stick around. Our interview with Samantha Anton is ahead next on Checkpoint XP Daily.
Checkpoint XP, esports and gaming radio. This is Checkpoint XP, esports and gaming radio. CheckpointXP.com.
Hey, welcome back to Checkpoint XP Daily. I want to thank everyone listening on our affiliate stations 101 Sports in St. Louis and WOKR 1310 in Rochester, New York. Coming up over the next seven episodes of Checkpoint XP Daily, we're going to check out interviews featured on our first national show of 2019, Checkpoint XP's educational special. So let's take a listen to Joe's conversation with Samantha Anton of the North American Scholastic Esports Federation, or NACEF.
Samantha, welcome to Checkpoint.
Happy to be here. Thanks, everyone.
Samantha, can you tell us a little bit about NACEF and what you guys do?
Right. So the North America Scholastic Esports Federation actually started off as an Orange County pilot program where we had 25 schools and 38 teams to come together, and they competed in League of Legends last April, and they had a lot of fun, and we ended up with one high school winning the entire tournament. But along the way, we really thought this is a great opportunity to connect esports and education and have them take something away a little bit bigger than themselves, other than them just competing and taking home, you know, a headset and a keyboard. So during this whole time, the Orange County Department of Education, UC Irvine, and ourselves partnered up to have a curriculum built out with English language arts, which embeds esports in it. So NACEF really is an educational platform that uses esports as a tool to have students, you know, have something that they're interested in, that they're really passionate about, but also something that gives them takeaways so that they can succeed after graduation.
You said you had 25 schools at the inception that started. That seems like a huge amount. What's the growth been like since then?
The growth has been great. Right now, since we've expanded to across North America, we're still in those stages where we're bringing on more states and more counties to be a part of it. But right now, we are at 100 that are in our system that we are working with. And really, everyone does, you know, everyone has their own way of being having esports on their campus or their club site. You know, some of them just want to have a place to meet, and they just want to come together and talk about, you know, Smash, or they just want to talk about something else that they watched on Twitch. And some of them want to compete, and that's really what they're passionate about. But for us, the club is the entry point where you have that president, you have that streaming coordinator, you have that team manager, and all those other things, so that you really are engaging not just the five kids that want to compete, you're really engaging everyone who can help make something big.
Well, it sounds like what you're trying to do is get people into esports as a way of getting them kind of into education.
Right.
Going back to, you know, even my time in high school, the school was always looking for a way to engage us kind of on our level. Mm-hmm. And they were really bad at it. I'll put it that way when I was in high school. So, I mean, it sounds like you're trying to give a more, like, legitimate way for kids to become engaged in their own education.
Right, exactly. And, you know, since we're partnered with UCI, a lot of it comes from academics and research influencing the way we make our decisions. So interest-based learning is one of the great ways that you can really reach those students who are either disenfranchised or maybe just not committed to their education, and pulling them in and giving them something to be a part of, and also tricking them to fall for that minimum GPA requirement, take that English class that challenges them a little bit. It's, you know, in a way, it's kind of cheating the system for the kids, but really we just want to give them something that they want to be a part of while also building the future leaders that are going to go out into the world.
Well, you know, in most cases when you hear about these esports clubs popping up, well, you know, 5 years ago, it's the students who have to do this. You know, you have to fight tooth and nail against the administration in order to get something like this to happen. And it sounds like you guys are building this from the top down. You know, the administration, mm-hmm. the teachers are getting involved. You're putting something out there that kids don't have to worry about working to be, you know, to become a part of it. They just get to join. I mean, what is the, what do you see within the kids when they just get to walk in and esports and in the gaming is just set up there and it's ready for them to go?
Right. I think the big part of it is just getting them started. When you have your principal convinced, when you have your teacher convinced to help the students out and create something, after that, once they're convinced, the students should take over. And if they want to hold that district-wide tournament, they should totally hold a district-wide tournament. It's just setting them up so that they don't have to fight as many barriers, because what happens with high school students is once that superstar student graduates, sometimes you lose all that great progress that happened on a campus. And so by being able to incorporate the administrators and the teachers, we're building a lot more infrastructure that can happen where even if the students graduate, there's still something there so that the next student doesn't have to start from scratch.
Well, that's very interesting to me. What is that process like? Like approaching administrators who probably in many cases have the same preconceived notions about esports and video games that many, you know, people in their 40s and 50s do. What is that process like?
Well, to start, it's a little bit of a myth that every principal is not sold on having esports on their campus, especially because the first thing everyone says is either, I wish I had this when I was in high school, which is probably the most common. And the
which
other
is what
one,
we said.
Right, exactly. And then the second thing that they say is, oh, I totally know about this. My daughter plays all the time. My son plays all the time. So we do encounter, though, those specific individuals, whether they're teachers, parents, or administrators, who are still not convinced. And a lot of it's just having those conversations. I mean, let's talk about Overwatch for a second. Overwatch is identified as a first-person shooter, right? But if you've ever watched Overwatch, if you sat down and watched with that person who thinks that Overwatch is violent, would they really consider Overwatch as a violent game? And I think those are the conversations that we have, and everyone's different, you know, whether it's the depiction of women or the violence that they think about or even just the community and the language that's used. How do we have those conversations that are honest? You know, we can be honest and say, yes, there are some communities in gaming that maybe their language is a lot more toxic than other games. Yes, that's a fact. But how can you as an adult intervene on these students to ensure that moving forward they're not perpetuating those things that are happening?
And that's really the value too of having, you know, live events where you're taking them out of that online only, I'm hidden behind the anonymity of my microphone, right, and now I'm sitting across from my opponent. When the match is over, I'm going to have to get up and go shake their hand. It seems like there's a big advantage in that.
Right. There really is. And it's honestly, kids are not inherently bad. They just need to be guided and pushed to the right direction. I mean, in our own community Discord, we've had situations where students are starting to butt heads, and it takes me or someone from my team to intervene and say, hey, this is what's happening. You know, we had something happen just this week about scrims, and someone was, I think, offended that another team didn't want to scrim against them because of their rank, because they were a little low. And then part of it's just, well, what's the purpose of the scrim? What if this other team that wants to scrim wants to compete against someone who's at their level so that they do better? And just having those conversations that it's not anything against you, that you're not good enough at the game. It's just that the goal that they want out of the scrim is to help them do better. And so for you, if your goal to scrim is just to get more practice, then just say that. When you want that scrim request, you know, just looking for another team to compete against, we just want to practice our comms. You know, that's totally fine to ask, but if you don't communicate that between teams, then they're just going to think you're being a jerk, or that you think that you're too good for everyone else.
Yeah, I actually wanted to touch on the parents aspect a little bit here, because, you know, when it comes to school, you know, three distinct groups. You have your students, your faculty, your parents. And growing up, you know, through traditional high school sports, parents can take a really, really big lead. What does the role of the parents look like in NESF and in the esports in high schools?
So every student that participates with us does have to get that parental approval. And, you know, every parent's different. Some of them are like, I trust my kid, I will sign whatever permission slip they want me because I trust them. But we have had some really monumental parents be really involved in getting it embedded in the school. So they're the ones having that conversation with the principal and asking, you know, oh, like, what can I do? And educate them a little bit more. So I think for the most part, though, as a parent, being supportive of your kid and being involved in their gaming experience, you know, rather than letting them in their room play and not be engaged with it, one, start playing with them. I think every time, I mean, Dr. Constance Steinkuhler is a great example. She's one of our technical advisors for NASEF, and she's a professor here at UCI in informatics, and she plays Overwatch with her sons, and that's super awesome.
So
and those
cool.
And when you play with your parents, you know, you're more likely not going to be dropping, you know, inappropriate language or being toxic or or being a bad person because I play with my mom and that's super awesome. So I think parents just being involved in any way that they individually can, including, you know, if your kid's in a tournament, you should be going to that tournament and being the front row cheering them on. And we did see that, which was really great for us in April in Orange County Esports Arena, to see parents who don't even know what's going on be like, well, like UCI, like a university is a part of this program and my kid is a part of this. You know, they're asking admissions questions, you know, can my kid really go to college and compete? And we're like, yeah, they totally can. And they can get a degree too. You know, a lot of our students here that are scholarship players are, you know, comp sci majors, art majors and the like. And even if they don't continue that path to pro, they still have something after the fact.
Well, and talking about the idea of going pro, it can be kind of a difficult tightrope to walk because for a lot of esports athletes, their prime, you know, money making time will be those college years, mm-hmm. those 4 years in college. 18 to 23 is kind of when you're at your best. What's it like, you know, guiding players either to the pros or mm-hmm. maybe saying like, you know what, where your abilities are at, you might not be able to make it as a pro, but there's tons of opportunities available in college and to maybe go even into management at some point. What is that like?
I think for both USAI Esports and for NACEF, our obligation really is to give them the tools to succeed no matter what path they decide to take. I can't speak to, oh, you're not good enough to make it to a high school student, because I don't know. Well, you can spend 2 months and get really good at this game and be a whole new person. But do you have the leadership or the communication skills or the management skills even to be able to, let's say you decide, I don't want to play this game anymore, but you still have all this knowledge in this game that is so relevant to the industry that you could be a manager or you could be a caster or anything like that. So it's really about how we can give them the tools so that even if they change their mind tomorrow, they still have something set forth for them. And you're right, 18 to 23 is such a critical time for them. So, I mean, we've had scholarship players leave and come back, and some of them just leave, and some of them graduate and they don't want to play, you know, Overwatch competitively anymore, but now they want to, you know, pursue their degree in pharmacy. So just giving them the options is what's important, I guess.
Samantha Anton, COO of NACEF, has been our guest here today.
Thank you.
We want to thank Samantha for her time, and if you want to learn more about NACEF, visit their website at esportsfed.org. That's going to do it for Checkpoint XP Daily, the first internationally syndicated show on esports for gaming for radio. Visit our website, checkpointxp.com, for insight on esports and gaming, as well as a full archive of podcasts and interviews. Join us Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. at twitch.tv/checkpointxp. Our theme is provided by the band Weird At Last. Find more at weirdatlast.com. Checkpoint XP Daily is a production of Beasley Esports XP. Thanks to our executive producing team of Buzz Knight, Mike Thomas, and Rick Scott. Lead segment producing by Joe Sloan. Producing and booking help from Christine Solis. And of course, my co-hosts who pulled double duties as producers for Checkpoint. Robbie Landis, Norris Howard, and Joe Sloan. My name's Nate Bender. Keep listening.
You've been listening to Checkpoint XP, a complete look at all things esports and gaming. Check out the latest esports and gaming news and opinions at checkpointxp.com.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.